You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
And Tracy, it's Saturday, it's game day, it's Pathfinder Day, and I got an email. I got an email from our guest today who was asking, do we use the video for anything? And our guest just found out what I use the video for.
Yeah. Yeah. That's basically that. Grogu's got a concussion by now. Like, he's got to go on protocol.
Oh, this Grogu, poor dude. Grogu has a, have you seen, there's actually a medical condition called metal neck.
What?
From headbanging.
Really?
Yeah. There's lots of
self-induced whiplash kind of thing.
There's musicians who suffer from this because they headbang on stage. Yeah.
Is that what's been going on with your neck all this time?
No, I secret have metal
Tech neck. Okay, it's different.
It's a similar thing. It's because I work with computers and I sit in front of a computer all day and night. And then my hobbies are on computers. And that, you know, you do that for as long as I have, and then you get herniated discs in your neck.
Yeah. I'm a high school teacher, so I have ring neck, and that's something I do to other people, not so much have done to myself. Yeah. But that's a
you also have like crippling debt because you're a teacher, so
still a turn.
Do I have crippling debt?
Teachers don't make a lot of money. Come on.
I married a guy who does computers. That helps.
Yeah.
Until they figure out how to AI a husbeast or something, I'll be okay. Mm. Yeah. Right. You know what? You can't AI. Guess.
Oh, you want to guess? What?
I mean, I'm not purely rhetorical.
Apparently, you can't AI a CEO of a corporation, but I challenge them to go ahead and do that and replace
That would be, I'm in favor of very, very, very little when it comes to AI, as you know, but let's give that one a spin. Yeah, sure. Why
let's
not?
Just replace all the
I think of a few to start with. What you can't AI is a really good comic. You could try to AI a really shit comic. But you definitely, if you were to sit there and prompt your little heart away, you wouldn't end up with anything like Free Planet, because you wouldn't have Aubrey Sitterson doing the work for you. So Aubrey, welcome aboard.
Thank y'all for having me. No, it's a treat. I'm a fan of y'all and your work and your oeuvre. And it's an honor to be a guest. A functional
we have an oeuvre. We upgraded French. That's fantastic.
I just learned that word. Thrilled to deploy it.
That's good. Yeah. You gotta work some practice in. It's kind of hard to like go to the taco truck or something and be like, an enchilada doesn't feel like it's my oeuvre.
My favorite taco truck does have an oeuvre, though. So I think there's a volume.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So congratulations on the volume one collection of Free Planet coming out in 2025. You were in Minneapolis actually recently for their Comic-Con in November. Yeah,
I was for Twin Cities Con, which is a great show. I'd been there a few years prior. I love that city. It's
quite a time to be loving Minneapolis.
Yeah, I know. That's not why I say it, though. I say it because I do legitimately love that city. It's such a cool place that, you know, aside from the horrific things going on in the city, separate from that, it's a world-class city. And people like myself who live in – I spent my entire adult life in Los Angeles and New York City. And it's very easy to fall into this trap of thinking that those are the big cities in this country and that's where everything
happens. The flyover country thinking.
Yeah. It's really easy to fall into. And I'm from Virginia originally, right? So like I get it. There are other places of this country, but still it's very easy to fall into that trap, especially when you're thinking about big, massive cities. But Minneapolis is a big, massive city with all that entails. It has its own culture. It has its own leisure activities and it's the scenes and the vibes, and it has its own identity that's separate from New York or LA or even Chicago, right? Another big Midwest city. It's a different thing. And I think that's awesome. And I miss regional differences. I miss there being, I think is really cool about Minneapolis is you walk around and you still see like the Minneapolis specific department stores.
Oh yeah.
right? And like, that's a that to me, because I remember growing up in Richmond, Virginia, and we still had some of them. And like, I watched as I got older, as they just got gobbled up and went out of business and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you still see that stuff in Minneapolis, the stuff that's specific to that city. And it's a big enough metropolis to support that. And I think that kind of thing existing outside of the lens of pop culture, in the way that, you know, LA and New York are like the center of,
yeah,
fosters a, you know, it's like the Galapagos Islands or something, right? Like it, okay. it fosters its own kind of like evolutionary paths and different things
okay.
there. And that's very exciting. It's a great city.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
but can you get
cool.
a tamale there?
I'm sure you can. I don't know if I would recommend it.
Is it top flight? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I'm sure you can.
Yeah. It's like my friend Donardo living in Houston after you know, being born and raised and living forever in New York, and complaining constantly that there's no such thing as a good bagel there, like you can't get one. And so me being a good friend, I always take pictures of the frozen bagels at King Supers and send them to him and go, well, what about these? Aren't these just fine? They're just bagels.
Have you tried these? Yeah, you know, I live in LA now, and it's tough to get any kind. I've been out here 12 or 13 years, and I still have very, very fussy requirements vis-a-vis bread foods, right? Like, and I think you can find good bagels, and you can find good pizza, and you can find good bread in LA. It's just a little tougher.
Part of the problem is California's declared a war on bread, as if I understand from sort of the like, there's just kind of a
it's kind of a detente right now. I think
people, that's good.
Yeah, things have calmed down a little bit in that regard.
The National Guard gets called if you get a pizza crust that doesn't have cauliflower in it.
In LA,
good pizza in California is Mionette's. But it is not New York style pizza. Mionette's.
I don't know what
Mionette's
is. What is that?
Well, it's Central San Joaquin Valley. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm a Southern California.
I don't think they go as far as LA.
The you know, in LA at least, the problem is the water. It's hard. It's hard water, and it comes in pipes from the Colorado River, and it's
lousy.
You
steal it from everybody else.
You steal it from everybody else, and it doesn't make good bread. It's bad.
That's the thing that always pissed me off about living in Fresno, is LA stole our water.
Yeah, that's correct.
And LA has no reservoirs.
That's not technically true.
You don't have enough. You have canals that gather the water and push it into the ocean.
Right out of the ocean. Yeah.
I am just sitting here on these Midwestern sidelines, like fight.
I read this really great book. It's called Island in the Land, and I forget who wrote it, but he was like a famous, labor attorney in LA in like the 30s, you know, and he also wrote articles for what became Westways, which is the AAA magazine in California. I think started in Southern California specifically. And he wrote articles about Southern California, hence Island in the Land. And it's hysterical because it came out in the 1930s and everything he describes, including it's insane. We get this torrential downpour a few times a year, and then we just shove it right out into the ocean, and then we're in a drought the rest of the year. It's nuts. He talks about that in the 1930s, almost 100 years ago. All the problems that people make fun of Southern California for, they've been with us since at least the 1930s.
This is exactly the type of squirrel moment where I do my this is my Olympics reference for today, my triple Sal Cow kind of like segue trick here, where that your ability to pull up this kind of like anthropological response to the LA's water situation is dumb is, I think, a sign of the kind of same brain wiring that actually gets us Free Planet, because this is like giant galactic science fiction that wants you to know that it has a history and a context. And that's something that I think we don't see a lot of in things that are science fictional outside of either like giant prestige film or like big doorstopper novels and things. And so I was wondering if you could kind of like help us get into your mindset here of like, what's the parts of your brain that said, I need to write something that is this?
First of all, that's the nicest focus. Hey, you look over here that I've ever experienced.
High school teacher.
Yeah, no, exactly. I could tell. You know, I've written quite a few comics over the course of my career, and Free Planet's different in exactly what you're describing. And that was a conscious choice because I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, I kind of came to this realization that I wasn't writing the types of comics that I like to read. I was writing comics that I liked to write, which wasn't necessarily the same thing. And I started thinking a lot about, you know, what to me, like when I consume a piece of art that is, that I find rewarding and rich and, you know, what does that entail? And for me, it's two things. It's complexity and it's ambiguity, right? And those are oftentimes in contemporary comics, including comics I've written, right? This is not a, I'm the only one doing this, right? Because I've fallen into this too. It's easy to think about comics from the perspective of film and television. And then you get rooted to this very specific type of pacing and it becomes somewhat limited in the types of complexity you can display because you aren't creating, instead of thinking primarily about creating an art object, which is what comics are, right? You are thinking about creating a plot and then breaking into scenes and then breaking into pages and panels. And this is a subtly different thing. And it's subtle. It's a subtle difference, but I think it's a pedantic difference. But I also think it's an important distinction, right? For me, the question then became, how do I create complexity and ambiguity and depth as an art object, right? This it's like, and this is separate from, you know, the way you do this when you are hewing to a more like television and film inspired approach. The way you do this is through metaphor, right? Or like character arcs. But these are somewhat limited when you compare to, you know, the big doorstopper novels, like you mentioned, right? And my home base as a kid consuming media, a lot of my peers were television and film folks, right? They dreamed of they made their own films and stuff like that. I never was. I was a novel kid. And I came to comics. I loved comics as well, but novels were more of my home base than television and film were. And so the question for me became, how do I create a novelistic depth in an art object, in something that still functions like a comic and not just functions as a comic, but uses those aspects of the medium that are inherent to comics to achieve that depth. And, you know, what I landed on was extensive amounts of research, just a lot, just overwhelming amounts of reading. And, you know, but again, like this was a revelation for me. I've done research for my comics before. I did a nonfiction book about the entire history of professional wrestling from the 1880s.
Which is wild, by the way.
go get it now. The comic book story of professional wrestling. But you know, so I'd done research before, but for nonfiction. And a lot of folks, you know, a lot of my peers will talk about research, but when you scratch the surface of what they're doing, they're just reading other fiction or they're watching things. And that's not unimportant, and it's not completely unhelpful, right? Because what you're doing there is you're learning about genre. And I certainly did genre research myself for Free Planet, right? Like reading, like just devouring everything Cord Wiener Smith, right? That was a big part of Free Planet and like figuring out aspects of that and what worked and how to riff off that and do something, you know, to draft off of what he had already created. But that's not real research, to my mind, right? Like, because if your research consists only of consuming other fiction, you're condemning yourself to be a mimic because you're not getting any new fuel. It's an Ouroboros, right? Mm-hmm. And you need to introduce new stuff into that cycle. And the way you do that is through researching real world things, reading nonfiction prose, reading the most information rich material that you can to inform this world that you're in the midst of creating.
Hold on, Tracy. It's interesting that you talk about becoming a mimic. Because there are some, not all, and I know Tracy is a teacher of creative writing. There are some creative writer teachers who will have you do an exercise of writing a story in the style of your favorite author.
I think that's amazing. I think more people should do that. I think it's that's do you do that, Tracy? Is that part of your?
I actually don't, but I recognize it as a move that I've been asked to do before when I was a student. And I think you and I are probably, Aubrey, valuing similar things about that exercise. But go off.
I will go off. I think it's insane that writing is the only art form that doesn't do that. If you're learning to paint, if you're learning to sculpt, if you're learning to do anything, you start off by mimicking, because before you go anywhere, you have to learn the bare minimum craft aspects, right? Before you can rebel against them, before you can refine them, before you can subvert them, you have to be able to know how to do it. And being able to work in these different registers is vital to that. Learning how to replicate someone else's style is essential to developing your own style. Absolutely. I think that's 100% true. And I think that's a really valuable exercise. And I think it's horrifying that I wasn't asked to do it more in my creative writing classes. Right. And I think I would have benefited from it a lot, especially at a younger age. But I don't think that's sufficient for the creation of complex work. Right. Like, because what you're doing, you're doing pastiches, and there's nothing wrong with that. And they can be great to read, but it's not new, challenging, complex work in the same way that something that is a style refined from the process of having done that earlier, informed by like actual research.
And so to that idea of like new and complex and different, I think if we were to imagine some other artist crafting something that looks like Free Planet, what they would do would be to pick up the arc of the story in a completely different place than you have done. Because the Free Planet that we get from you and your co-creators is a story of the revolution is over, in the sense that we have liberated, this planet has liberated itself from this sort of this powerful hegemonic force. But it's not as simple as saying, cool, now we're liberated. Like, there is the question of governance. There's a question of how do we create stability? What do we do with the fact that the hegemon may very well come back and isn't particularly interested in us maintaining our liberty? Like, what does that look like? And I think the traditional move of a lot of comics media in particular, because a lot of mainstream comics tend to really privilege action. And why not? Action is fun. That we would be actually involved in the narrative of here is the battle for liberty. The idea that Free Planet's arc picks up specifically and deliberately with the declaration of victory and independence, and now what comes after, is a huge part of what makes it a distinct experience from these other things. And I think when you're talking about that research and that different approach, my sense is that's a lot of what you're talking about as well.
Of course. Yeah, no, I mean, and it's, that's certainly been informed. So, you know, it's a book about world building in a couple different ways, right? Like, it is dense and expansive world building in the sense of speculative fiction, but it's also about, the story is about them trying to build this new world, right? The first completely free planet in human history. And, you know, that has all been very much informed by the research, but it was also a conscious choice to start it where we did, you know, very much tied to comics tradition of heroic fiction, right? Which I love. And, you know, I worked at Marvel Comics. I love superhero comics. This isn't a knock on these broader genres and approaches. And, you know, even outside of superhero things that aren't superhero comics and comics, they oftentimes are, right? They're the superhero, they have the trappings of a crime comic or a horror comic or a sci-fi comic, but at the end of the day, they really are superhero comics. Or at the very least, they are pulp action adventure comics, right? Of which, you know, superhero comics grew out of. What's my point here? Oh, what am I even talking about? You know, so this tradition of action adventure, superhero, pulp heroes, it is at its core about protecting the status quo. That is deeply tied to these genres and their tropes and how they're structured and who the villains are and who the heroes are and their relationships with society and how they are viewed by people. Even the fact that they are heroes and these elevated figures, the one man who can solve this huge problem and save an entire city. That in and of itself is a reactionary worldview. That is a reactionary fantasy, right? And that is a thing that comic book creators, I think, should grapple with constantly, right? Is that the genres that have defined our medium have these very, very core assumptions about not only what the world looks like, but what the world should look like, right? And that's fun, and I've done work in that mode, but I don't find it terribly complex. I find that to be a very simplistic, easy worldview, right? The story of the revolution can be stirring and emotional, but it's, you know, you've got a bad guy and you've got a good guy, and then you're rooting for one of them, and then it ends. And that, to me, it kind of flattens the complexity of real world combat and conflicts and struggles for liberty. And all the reading I've done, you know, one of the things that comes up again and again is there aren't really any perfect actors, you know, and that to me was important, an important component of this complexity.
So I have a question.
It's your show, man. You're just kind of
This is coming directly from one of our patrons, Robert, who recently answered this question last year on another podcast. What was the first comic book that really grabbed you and made you go, "Oh, okay, this is comic. This is the thing"? Because for me, it was G.I. Joe number 21, Silent Interlude.
Oh, cool.
Which has no words in it, because it's all from Snake Eyes' point of view. And he doesn't speak. So what's that comic book for you? What was the comic book that made you go, "This is what I want to do"?
Oh, interesting. I wish it wasn't this, because it sounds like a really hack, basic answer. But it was Watchmen. It really was. I grew
not
up
the Great Lakes Avengers.
Not the Great Lakes. I worked on Great Lakes Avengers at Marvel. It's funny that you mentioned that. So I was primarily a comic strip kid. Right.
I was doing it for a while.
And it wasn't because I held my nose up at comic books. It was because I lived in ex-urban Richmond, Virginia, and like, I don't know, these like idyllic stories about like hopping on your bike and riding to the comic shop. No, that would be like a 20-minute drive from anything, you know? And so that wasn't really an option. But the newspaper got delivered to our house. And, you know, having That was my comic source for many, many years. And, you know, if I got to go to the mall with my mom, and I would go camp out at Walden Books and read like collections of comic strips. And that was always the hit for me. And I liked comic books, but I just didn't get them that often. Right. It was rare for me to have access to them.
I was reading, you know, Garfield and stuff like that. But I also was reading, you know, Bloom County.
Bloom County was my favorite.
But then I noticed there was this other thing in the paper as well. It was called Prince Valiant. I would see cool. Prince Valiant, and I'm going, "Well, this is different. This is different." But then my friend for my birthday gave me G.I. Joe. And to your point, the closest comic book store to me in Fresno was actually in Clovis. And so I had to – and I saw a commercial for it while watching Robotech. I was watching Robotech, and they're like, "Hey, do you like Robotech?"
That's a well-placed commial. They knew who their audience was.
Yeah. It was basically, if you like Robotech, we have Robotech comic books, we have Robotech toys, we have all the stuff. You know, come to see our comics and cards in Clovis. And so I begged my mom. And I want to say that was like a 35, 40-minute drive to get to see our comics and cards from our house. And she took me. And that was it for me. I was like, "Holy crap, I had no idea all this existed."
Yeah, dude, I had the same experience, but it was later. I went to school in New York City, and all of a sudden I lived in a place where there were comic shops everywhere. There's a million of them, and they were great. They were world-class comic shops, and it was a walkable city. and I could go to all of them. And I did. And I fell down the rabbit hole really, really quickly. And, you know, Watchmen was a book that I had like heard mentioned before. You know, this is, well, I'm old enough. This is well before the movie. Right? Like, it wasn't really as embedded in pop culture the way it is now. And I read it and, you know, it was the first time, you know, that's not necessarily true because I'd read Mouse as a kid and that really knocked me on my ass. But, you know, I read it way too young. I read Mouse when I was like in second grade because like it was a bit.
That's not it, baby.
After the Scholastic catalog.
Yeah.
I mean, the Scholastic catalog is an interesting document of subversiveness, is it not?
It is. But I was way too young, and it horrified me. And it like, I don't know, like it really stuck with me, and it did a number on me. But it didn't really. It wasn't until I read Watchmen that I really started to look at comics, the same way that I looked at novels. Honestly, because I think that Watchmen is a primo example of a comic that has this novelistic depth, right? And there's specific techniques that Watchmen formalized and used famously and innovated that have kind of become de rigueur. And so it's easy. It's sometimes difficult to look back, you know, with any influential work, sometimes it's difficult to look back and really fully grasp how different it was. But no, it was Watchmen for sure. Like reading something, you know, in the back matter, which I think, you know, we certainly do our fair share of like text back matter in issues of Free Planet.
Yeah. In the same way that for Watchmen, we have these sort of interlocutive documents, like we've got the pirate comic within the larger world. We have the documents and things tracking the sort of vigilante superhero groups and so on. You have your own kind of meta character and Dr. Aldous Foyereshi, and interestingly that meta character seems to have really expanded for you, because if someone were to, I don't know, go to aubreysitterson.substack.com, for instance, they would see that if they have questions about Free Planet, they are in fact to direct them to an email address that is specifically for Dr. Aldous Foyereshi, this kind of meta historian of your story world.
Readers have sent in questions and he answers them. The letters page for Free Planet, you know, it's a comic book classic, the letters page, but ours is a little bit different because it's staffed by Dr. Foyereshi, and he answers reader questions about like really shockingly specific lore and world questions about like currency and exchange rates and economic systems. People have dug in and had a lot of fun with it. So that's been a joy too, honestly. Like that's been one of the most gratifying things about doing Free Planet is that people are interested enough to play along.
Well, and the questions that they're asking are, I imagine in some cases, actually prodding you to develop parts of the lore that you hadn't had reason to consider yet. And they're 100%. Like, well, now I'm about to expand the canon, I guess. I better keep track of this.
100%. I mean, it's been fun and helpful and rewarding in that regard too, you know, because like my, a thing that comes up frequently when I talk with folks about Free Planet is they say, well, how much of this did you plan? Like what's your story Bible look like? And like, how much of this world have you built out? And the answer is a lot, but like, I think that, you know, and this is true of any kind of storytelling, but especially in comics because of the formal aspects of the medium. It really is the art of what you don't say, right? Like, and it's not even a matter of, oh, you want to imply things instead of saying things. Because I think like people get caught up in that, right? Like show, don't tell. And people interpret that, I think, a little bit too literally and rigidly. Because at the end of the day, you have to tell people things. if you don't tell people things, like, you know, especially in a comic, the comic would be 8,000 pages, right? If you really wanted to show visually everything you wanted to tell people, that's not really the thing. It's not about implying. It's about garden pathing the reader to infer. Mm. Which is, oh man, you're getting all my pedantic distinctions today. but I think this is key, right? Because this is how you draft off of historical elements. This is how you draft off pre-existing genre elements. You as a creator have in mind what the reader already knows and their worldview and kind of like the the instantaneous associations that they're going to make with the things that you're presenting to them, such that if you know you've got that in place already, you can build off that, right? And I think that this extends also to this kind of world building stuff. It all needs to be consistent and it all needs to fit together. It all needs to be well thought out, but you commit to the smallest amount at a time in order that people will infer what you need them to infer in order to appreciate the work properly. And you're right. The letters pages are an amazing help for that, right? Because people, you know, if people have a question, they see it answered, or they see a question and then they answer it. It then fills in for them a blank that they are able to hang everything else upon.
Mm-hmm. Or they see your letter talking about Savick and they send you a letter saying, hey, I'm doing a fanzine about Savick. Would you like to write a story for it?
wait, I'm sorry. Am I missing it? I'm missing the
game. He's being autobiographical in this case.
I'm not as well researched on your oeuvre, apparently.
Yeah, no, Patrick's letters page experience has a very different arc.
Yeah.
So
Star Trek.
Yeah. Always the Star Trek thing. The letters page is a trip, man. This is a semester that I teach my speculative fiction studies class to my students, and I always talk to them about how Hugo Gernsback's Amazing Stories in 1926 was kind of like the beginning of nerd culture, in the sense that it had a letters to the editor page, and as people would read letters other people wrote, they got the idea of writing back to whomever, care of Amazing Stories. And ultimately, Gernsback decided to run those letters in the back pages, so that essentially you had, and the students, when I tell them about this, I always kind of get this like glassy look there. And I'm like, imagine the world's slowest Discord. And they're like, oh, like that. And I'm like, yeah. And so this is, you are, In this age of technology, you're bringing back the world's slowest Discord. Good job.
Well,
good
job. I mean, I think it's something that it's a very comic booky thing, right? And like, yeah. Again, you know, so much of what is very comic booky grew out of those pulps, right? Like, yeah. Inclusive of letters pages. But I think that this is funnily enough, relevant to my earlier rambling about the Galapagos Islands, right? Like, this is an essential part of these very specific genres and cultures.
They're weird little ecosystems.
They need to be, right? They absolutely need to be. And that doesn't mean, that's not to say that they need to be exclusive or gatekept or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But actually having a place for people to cross-pollinate their ideas, but also develop their own tropes and worldviews and aesthetic and tone, that is crucial to the development of these discrete, specific genres and approaches to art, I think.
It's a good time for our discrete and specific time that we call Picks of the Week.
Hell yeah.
Welcome to February. How's it going? You enjoying it so far? Yeah. Good. Oh, by the way, we'll get to Picks of the Week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month, and that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month, and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever, our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on, what are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, give us a pick.
My pick, I've already talked about this a little bit on the Discord and for our patrons, but there was a show that was on years and years and years ago that I started, but then life interrupted. I never concluded the show, and then it went off the air, and then it hasn't been conveniently located for streaming in a really long time for me. And it recently dropped along with a bunch of other shows on Netflix. And it's called Falling Skies. And this is Noah Wiley post-ER, before the new ER reboot thing that he's doing. And I think also before Librarians. This is a 5-season show. And it starts with the Earth has already been invaded and conquered. And there are aliens running everything. And there's human resistances that are trying to fight back. And he is a history professor. He has 3 sons. And one of the sons was taken by the aliens because they take kids and they put these devices on their spines that control them, called harnesses. Mm. And so part of his goal is trying to find his middle son and rescue him from the aliens, but also, you know, free humans from this alien occupation force. And it's really good. I enjoy it. And I just finished the first season. Everything I remembered about the first season, which is only like 10 episodes, was there. And it's good stuff. It's good science fiction. The aliens are called Skitters. They run around on 6 or 8 legs. But then you find out, like, spoiler alert later on, that there's a hierarchy of aliens above them. And they have mechs. And they have, you know, better weapons than the humans, and the humans are just trying to get by. And it's very survival-y, because mm-hmm. you have, it's called the Second Massachusetts is the organization that he's with, and he's the second in command. And they're always struggling to find, you know, weapons, ammunition, food to feed everybody. They've got a civilian population that they're trying to support as well, who are kind of traveling with them. They're trying to rescue kids. They're trying to stop the aliens, do damage wherever they can, you know, and it's initially set in Boston. So it's a good show. I enjoy it quite a bit. Falling Skies, and it's currently on Netflix.
Nice. Nice. So Aubrey, what has been bringing you joy?
I'm reading this book. It's by James Hopkirk. It's called The Great Game. Do you know about The Great Game?
I guess I don't.
Okay. So it's nonfiction. In the 19th century, so 1800s, England controlled, the English Empire controlled India, right? I'm doing hand motions.
Yeah, it's good.
I need to point out the map to be able to think about it. England controls India, right? Through the British East India Company. Meanwhile, the Russian Empire, the Tsarist Russian Empire is expanding at an outrageous rate. It's taken over the Caucasus. It is moving into Central Asia, right? This concerns England because India is the source of their empire's wealth. And since time immemorial has been the source of wealth in the Eurasian continent, they're worried about Russia streaming down from the Caucasus through what is now Afghanistan, conquering India, right? Or at least starting a war that that England has to then fight on this front that's so far removed from England.
Oh, is this one of those things where we're just reminded that anytime you go through Afghanistan, it's a bad idea?
This is where it starts. This is the beginning of it. This is the great game. So simultaneously, Russia is trying to chart a path through these horrible deserts and mountainous passes controlled by warring tribes and khanates and all these different groups that hate each other but hate Europeans even more. The Russians are trying to chart a course for their armies to travel down to India. Meanwhile, the English are trying to figure out where they, like, what the stoppage points would be, where they can put up defense along those same paths. No maps exist. People don't know the languages. They don't know the cultures. It is an incredibly violent part of the world. And they send individual guys, individual officers to go explore this path. And it is, and make alliances and work against one another and commit espionage. This is the great game. And it has direct continuity with, so I'm a big John le Carre spy novel guy.
Oh, yeah.
This has direct continuity with the struggles between England and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. This is where it all began. And it is also the most, the most arrogant, swaggering, imperialist adventure stories you can possibly imagine, because each chapter is told about a single guy, basically, right? So it's personality based, and it's about these Europeans, like, disguising themselves as Muslim holy men and learning the languages and trying to, like, safely gain passage, or pretending to be horse traders when they're really diplomats or spies. It's upsetting stuff in terms of seeing the seeds of 150 years of conflict in Central Asia, but it's also really righteously exciting stuff. It's a complex read. I adore it.
Yeah, fantastic. Absolutely. All right, so true to form, I'm going to recommend a game. And this is one of my Christmas gifts that's hit the table a couple of times here in Shea Townsend, and it's really kind of so thematically on the nose that I sort of feel like I need to apologize to Aubrey. It's called Origin Story, and it is a trick-taking card game produced by Stonemaier Games. I am, to be clear, not usually a trick-taking card game kind of gal. Like, if something is based on the mechanics of, like, spades, for instance, I'm sort of like, that's fine. I'll go over here and read a book. But Origin Story is fascinating because it somehow manages in an extremely clever way to graft onto a trick-taking card game a sort of tableau building model where what you're really doing is telling your superhero's origin story. So every person gets a player character mat that is in fact a cardboard foldout that is a comic book. And it's a wordless comic that has multiple panels. Every panel is numbered, and it both shows something that's happening in the origins of your particular character, and then it also creates a space on which, for this round, you're going to play a new card that modifies how your character does stuff. It's effectively a trick-taking card game with a separate deck of cards that represent, like, your powers and your nemesis and, like, your sidekicks and various other things that are shuffled to you and you get to make choices from that allow you to break certain elements of the trick-taking card game. And this allows you to work in all sorts of cool tropes from the comic book world. Like, there's a card that you can use called Amnesia that allows you to flip from playing as a hero character to a villain character, because hero and villain characters score in different ways in a given round, and so on. And so they find all sorts of really genuinely interesting ways to kind of take the language and the tropes of superhero comic books and to translate them into gameplay mechanics that actually make sense and feel organic and not weirdly fused on in a tiny little, about the size of a paperback book, card game that plays in 45 minutes for 1 to 5 players. So if you're the sort of person who's got a group of people in your life who kind of like card games, and they kind of like comic books, or maybe really like one or both of those, but aren't necessarily down for something that's going to burn their whole night, Origin Story teaches so easily. It plays so smoothly. And it's just genuinely a really good time.
Very cool. Conversely, I have Steelheart, which was Brandon Sanderson's take on superheroes. That was a Kickstarter game that's been sitting on my shelf for like, 6 years? I don't think it's
Brandon doesn't available. Mind. That's okay. Yeah. he's fine with
that. He got paid either way, man.
Yeah. It could stay in shrink. All right. Well, so Aubrey, it has been wonderful having you on.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
So where can people find you in the near future, continue to find Free Planet and other works, and otherwise support what you're doing?
So first and foremost, I'm mortally embarrassed. I have not once mentioned my co-creator, Jed Dougherty, who is not only my co-creator, but he's the artist on Free Planet. It would not be a comic without him. He is essential to the process. We didn't talk about the process of making the art and all, but he's crucial. And I don't know, I'm going to flagellate myself later for not mentioning him earlier.
Okay, we'll tell on you to Jed.
Tell me to Jed. He'll flagellate me also. You can find me, I'm easy to find, Aubrey Sitterson. Just Google me. I'm on all social media. AubreySitterson.com is my website. My newsletter, which we mentioned earlier, that's probably the best way to keep up with me. You can go to AtlantisStillSunk.com, and it'll take you right to it. Free Planet Volume 1, The Trade, collecting issues 1 through 6, is everywhere books or comics are sold right now. If you have a local comic shop, I recommend you go to them, ask them to order it for you, but you can also order it literally anywhere else. It's a monthly comic. They keep coming out. Issue 9 drops on February 11th, always on Wednesdays. Issues 7 and 8 will not be collected in the trades. Those are just for single issues, so track those down before they disappear.
Very nice. So if you are listening to this episode when it drops, you will have 1 day to race to your local comic shop and get yourself some back issues before you get issue 8.
There you go.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us, Aubrey.
Thank you for having me. This has been so fun.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake. Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.